The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The common academic way to do this is that you would take tracts written by Islamist actors and translate them and shove them in an appendix, and maybe your authors have reacted to those in some way, but it's a pretty static enterprise and the conversation is one way. What Shadi and I wanted to do was involve these actors that were being studied much more in the process and to illuminate this dynamic for what it is, which is an interchange between analysts who study this thing and that thing reacting to the analysis, and then the analysts themselves rethinking what they've written. And so this book then is an attempt to give voice to the Islamists, but make sure they are in conversation with the scholars, and the scholars really shaping the debate. So it's not the Islamists just given a platform and allowed to speak unchallenged to the world, but it's really in conversation with the scholars that are studying them, which is unusual for a publication on political Islam.
I'm Vanessa Sauter, and this is the Lawfare Podcast. October 14th, 2017. Political Islam has been radically shifting in the past 4 years, since the Egyptian coup and the emergence of ISIS, consequently challenging how we understand Islamist movements and their impact. To evaluate the evolution of mainstream Islamist groups and the obstacles they face in governance, Brookings Senior Fellows Shadi Hamid and Will McCants led an initiative to assess these movements across 12 countries, compiling field research from a group of leading specialists in their recently released book, Rethinking Political Islam. Benjamin Wittes interviewed Shadi and Will on their book, discussing the scope of the volume, the common themes across the major movements, and the nuances of movements in countries like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Syria. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 252, Rethinking Political Islam.
So this is a really unusual project and a really ambitious one in scope, and I'd like you both to start by describing what it is and how it came to be and what it grew out of.
Yeah, I think Shadi and I both watched the same events from two different vantage points. Shadi, you were there at Tahrir Square when Mubarak came down. And of course, I've been watching Al-Qaeda and then ISIS for years. And the Arab Spring really created a new dynamic both for mainstream Islamist groups, these groups that have, you know, large popular following and stay within the bounds of normal politics in their country, and then the groups I follow, which operate outside of those bounds. And it created space initially for both of them to operate. So I think Shadi and I felt like there needed to be some kind of volume collecting the responses of at least the mainstream folks and how they reacted to those two events.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, obviously, and rightfully so, ISIS does get a lot of attention. So when people think about Islamism, they might think about the extremist groups that commit terrorist acts and are quite obviously violent and brutal. But we wanted to make sure with this volume that, you know, we were keeping an eye on the groups that maybe have gotten less attention over the years. And those are, as Will said, what we would call mainstream Islamist movements. And I mean, quite a lot has happened over the past few years. So part of the effort here is to sort of take stock 6 years after the Arab Spring. We see the rise of ISIS. We see the failure of the Arab Spring. we see the coup in Egypt, which is sort of a landmark moment for many of these movements, in the sense that the coup overthrew the Muslim Brotherhood-led government. And most of the groups that we're looking at here are either Brotherhood affiliates or Brotherhood-inspired groups. So what we wanted to do with the 12 country cases was to look systematically at each of the major Islamist movements in these countries and try to see what the commonalities and differences were. And I think importantly, too, we wanted to make sure we cover at least some non-Middle Eastern countries that we think are really important, but people, you know, don't always pay much attention to. And in this case, that would be Indonesia, Malaysia, and Pakistan.
Okay, so let's talk about the geographic scope and range of the book, because it's actually, so looking at the table of contents here, you actually start after the introduction with the subheading countries, and then the first 11 chapters of the book, before you get to any cross-cutting discussions of issues, are country surveys. And I'm interested in sort of why you started. Like, most people think of it as a, you know, there's this sort of broad movement, Islamism, that has certain things in common. And that's, of course, the way a lot of the Islamic movements in question themselves think about it, right? They purport to represent some transnational set of ideas and values and governance. You broke it down initially by countries, and I'm interested in that choice, and I'm interested in your sense of what the level of geographic range and difference is, and how much this is the same story being told 12 different times or 11 different times.
Well, so the really cool thing about this volume is that, well, first of all, Will and I think, are pretty aggressive editors, so we weren't sort of kind of taking a step back and letting people write whatever they wanted to. And we asked each of the contributing authors to read all of the other country cases. And we also had a meeting here in DC where we brought them together and to just talk through their different cases. We wanted to make sure that, so the person who's writing the Yemen chapter is aware of what's going on in, say, Jordan or Syria. And that's something that's actually quite rare, that we get stuck in these silos, that the group of people who work on one movement don't really know as much as maybe you might expect about the other movements. So that was, I think, a really important part of this project. So it was collaborative and iterative. But also, I think, what we found out in terms of looking at the contributions is that the cases can actually be quite different, that there isn't a lot of repetition. Obviously, there are some cross-cutting themes that come up, and that's important, obviously. But I think there's this, the cases are quite unique in their own ways. And if you think of, yeah.
So let's unpack that a little bit. At some level, it's not, it's kind of a duh point, right, that Indonesia and Egypt are not really the same thing. Yeah. But on the other hand, we do all, at least those of us who don't do Islamic movements for a living, we do have a sense of common themes and cross-cutting themes among, you know, major Islamic movements. And so I'm interested, like, what does the variance look like? I mean, I know that Ennahda in Tunisia is really different. Like, what's the range of variation that we're seeing here?
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that the Islamists themselves, while they also buy into this idea that there's some pan-national movement, transnational movement that they're a part of, really, when they get together in a room, it's like they're speaking different political languages because their contexts are so profoundly different. So the guys from Indonesia, where they never win more than, say, 8% of the vote for parliament, are very content to be minority parties and try to pull everyone to the right, as opposed to, say, Egypt, where there is a much larger base of support for the main Islamist group there, the Muslim Brotherhood. And they won, what, Shadi? Something like...
altogether six rounds, a lot, consecutive elections, 2000... 2011, 2013, around six, I would say. Yeah, depending on what you count. But
right. And so a much larger base of support, much greater success in the polls, much longer history of antagonism with the government. And so those experiences then in Indonesia and Egypt, for example, profoundly shape their strategies. And it doesn't mean that it dictates their behavior, but it really puts limits on what's possible, and what's possible in sense of their own thinking as well. I mean, that was also striking to Shadi and me. You know, the way that Islamist actors think about politics differs greatly from region to region just because of their very different context. Some of them are very obsessed with winning outright elections. Others are happy to just be a minority party or not even be in party politics.
Okay, so let's actually play with this, and you know, without going into depth in any of these, let's go through these countries and what's the headline of Islamist politics in each of them. Some of them, the listeners, I think, will have a better instinctive sense of than the others, but I'll just throw out the names of the countries in the orders that you guys put them in the book, and whichever of you wants to take that country, give us a couple sentences on where we are. I assume, Shadi, you should take Egypt.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is sort of the mother movement for Islamist movements. And so it's really, we thought it was important to obviously start with that, and also in the context of the Egyptian coup of 2013 and the massacre as well, the worst mass killing in modern Egyptian history, which becomes another one of these decisive moments in the Islamist imagination, the Rabaa massacre. And what we see in Egypt is really unprecedented levels of repression. So we can talk about Mubarak, Sadat, or even Gamal Abdel Nasser in the 50s and 60s. What we've seen under the current president, Sisi, is actually worse than that. Tens of thousands of people in prison. The two contributors from the Muslim Brotherhood in this volume are in exile in Istanbul. So in that sense, it's a very challenging environment, which has led to quite considerable internal divisions within the Egyptian Brotherhood on some pretty key questions. And one of those is the use of tactical or situational violence. So what some Muslim Brotherhood members call quote-unquote defensive violence or smart violence. And for them, that's obviously a way to justify something which they hadn't been doing. And the Brotherhood has not been using violence for most of its history. But also questions around how revolutionary should Islamist movements be? Because under Mubarak, they never even used the word revolution. And now you hear this kind of more confrontational revolutionary rhetoric. And that's, I think, a really important thing to remember about these groups, that they were very gradualist. They were playing the long game. They were very careful and cautious. But with the Arab Spring, you see a new dynamic where they have to contend with, hey, is this gradualist approach to politics, is that effective? Is that successful? And not just in Egypt, and we can talk about this as well, but also in context of civil war. That's a new dynamic that the Arab Spring introduces, is civil wars in quite a few countries, right? In Libya, Syria, and Yemen. So in those three countries, the question of violence becomes even more of a concern than we see in Egypt, because you actually have militias taking up arms. And the question then becomes, do Muslim Brotherhood movements in those countries, what do they do about that? Even if they're not comfortable with violence, everyone else is comfortable with violence. Everyone is taking up arms for the most part in, say, Syria. So then the Brotherhood has to be like, well, we renounce violence and we've been trying to stay away from that because of our previous bad experience with taking up arms in the late 70s, early 80s. So, I mean, that's why a lot of these conversations are, in a sense, new. So the Libyan Brotherhood is having a conversation about violence that they hadn't been having, say, 8 or 9 or even 15 years ago.
Tunisia.
Yeah, right. Well, that's one you'll definitely have to kick to Shadi, too, because that's another area of his expertise. But I was going to say, especially if you want a good comparison, look at Jordan and Morocco. You know, Jordan and Morocco are both monarchies. They both have a long history of providing some kind of space for their Islamist parties, particularly in Jordan. And their participation, the Islamist participation in politics, has been much more routinized. So when the Arab Spring came along, there were already defined paths of protest. The Jordanian Brotherhood in particular did what it usually does, which is boycott elections off and on. And they have been able, those governments then have been able to manage their Islamist dissent in ways that these other governments couldn't. When the state is collapsing, when revolution is breaking out, it doesn't mean that those Islamist groups are forever going to be content to operate within the system. But when they're given a little bit of room, they tend to conform to the rules of the political game. It's just when the ruler is gone, then the game completely changes, which is what happens in Egypt and these other countries. Ennahda in Tunisia is another interesting counterpoint to what happened in Egypt, because you know the ruler goes down there, but you don't have civil war, and the Islamist party ends up working ultimately closely with their secular opponents, trying to keep the transition on the rails, because what keeps them in locked embrace with the secularists is the fear that the project could completely collapse and they could revert to an authoritarian.
Yeah, so this is what's striking, is that you can look at the Egyptian coup and take quite different lessons from it. So some Libyan Islamists saw the Egyptian coup and said, hey, the lesson here is that you better protect yourself with arms, because people are going to try to push you out of power and repress you. And Nahda took almost the opposite lesson and said, we don't want what happened in Egypt to happen to us, so we're going to make a lot of compromises. We're going to voluntarily step down from power, even though they were democratically elected. And, you know, there was some debate about whether that's a good idea to just voluntarily give up power. In that sense, I think there was a paranoia on the part of Ennahda members. They were so afraid of going back to the way things were before. So they really did prioritize doing whatever it took to survive. And if that meant making forming coalitions with secular parties, so be it. If that meant de-emphasizing their Islamic identity, so be it. And that's the other really interesting thing about Ennahda, is they really make this mad rush to the center. And some people would, you know, make jokes during the last Tunisian election in 2014 that if you heard some of the secularists on TV, they would sound more Islamic than Ennahda leaders. But that also gets into this challenging question: when you have Islamists doing this kind of makeover and trying to look very, you know, nice, fluffy, and gentle in the eyes of the international community, how much of that is tactical and how much of that really reflects a deeper ideological shift? And there's no way to conclusively answer that until, let's say, 10, 20, 30 years from now. We'll see. But that's a debate that will be ongoing for quite some time.
And it raises, of course, the question of what does it mean to be an Islamist, right? If you're running in an electoral system in which it's hard to distinguish between the party that's avowedly Islamist and the party that's avowedly secularist, and people are making jokes that the secularist party sounds as more Islamic than the Islamist party, then it becomes a question of whether the identity has political meaning, or whether it's just a historical label that we're using in that political context to mean more conservative.
Exactly. And I think this is, so I think we as Westerners, we look at a movement like Ennahda, and I think our tendency is to give them a lot of credit because, first of all, it's like the only bright spot in the Arab Spring, right? But I think that we've always been asking Islamist movements to play nice, to kind of become normal, to become less Islamist. And they do that in some cases, as in Tunisia. But then you have to ask yourself, for their own domestic constituency, is it worth it? Because presumably for a lot of their own conservative base, they vote for Ennahda because Ennahda is Islamist. Islamists are Islamist for a reason. If they stop being Islamist, then what's the point? So you can look at it from different perspectives. And I think we're also, this book happens to come out in sort of an era where we're seeing the return of ideology, identity, and religion throughout the world in a lot of different contexts. So it's very, I mean, to Ennahda in that sense is very much an odd case in a broader context because they're making a rush to the center when everyone else is trying to win elections by rallying their base and by giving red meat to their own constituency. And Ennahda has actually lost some of its own. There's a lot of grumbling within the party among the rank and file. They didn't do as well in the last election. So there's a real question, even if it's good for the country, is it good for the party if you're not as successful in elections because you're playing too nice and there's not as much as distinctive about who you are and what you stand for.
What about Saudi Arabia? So you have a chapter on Saudi Arabia, and I look at that and I say it's a weird context in which to talk about Islamism because, of course, the state itself purports to be Islamic and purports to not have any law other than Quranic law. And so, you know, what's the role of Islamism in Saudi Arabia and how has it changed over this period?
Yeah, it's been a complicated dance for Saudi's Islamists. One, for the reason you say that they are dealing with a state that is already deeply conservative and implements many conservative features of Islamic law. But the Islamists also have these transnational ties, particularly to other Arab countries. And after the Arab Spring, there was a lot of agitation that the Saudi monarchy was in a reactionary mode, particularly after the coup, the Sisi coup in Egypt. So a number of clerics or leaders tied to the Muslim Brotherhood or having sympathies with the Muslim Brotherhood began to speak out, particularly after the massacres at Rabaa. And as a consequence, Saudi has moved to place further constraints on their behavior. I mean, this is the same group of people that back in the 1990s was really advocating for much more limited constitutional monarchy. They had their wings clipped then, and they are having their wings clipped again as a consequence of the Arab Spring and their vocal support for it. So while there's no Islamist party in Saudi Arabia because there's no parliament, and while there's not a legal Muslim Brotherhood, they still operate in these loose networks to try and put pressure on the monarchy. But with that government going through a major generational transition in its leadership, they've started clamping down hard on domestic opposition or people they think will be opposed to them during the transition. That's why a number of these influential religious scholars have been put in prison recently. So Saudi is a good case where, you know, you have not had a transition in government. You have a very different political context. And as a consequence, the Islamist activism is more muted. I mean, it's still there. There's still agitation for change, but it is much more muted than these other contexts.
One other thing I'd note on this is that, you know, Islamism is a modern construct. So if we were alive like four centuries ago, the word wouldn't make any sense. It wouldn't exist. It exists today because Islamism requires its opposite. Islamism wouldn't make sense without secularism or liberalism or alternative ideologies that try to limit Islam's role in public life. So that presents, you know, an issue in the case for more religiously conservative countries like Saudi Arabia, where there aren't really liberals, there aren't really secularists, because it is basically an Islamic state in one way or another. So to be an Islamist has less meaning than it would say in Tunisia or Turkey, where there are not just secularists, but hardline secularists. So I think that part of it's important to remember, that Islamists define themselves in opposition to whatever else is out there in a given country.
You have a distinct chapter on Kuwait, but not on any of the other small Gulf countries. And so I'm interested in why Kuwait, and what's distinctive about Kuwait, and is it there as a representation of the other Saudi satellite Gulf countries, or is it there because of something distinctive about itself?
Yeah, Kuwait is there because it has long experience with including Islamists in parliamentary politics. So I think Islamists have run in Kuwaiti elections at least 2 decades, maybe 3, going back to the early 80s. And it's not just the Muslim Brotherhood type. They have their own political party. It's also ultra-conservative Salafis. So they're very much part of the normal political landscape. And it is much more comparable to, say, Jordan, again, because you have a monarch that is the ultimate executive, but in the case of Kuwait, allows the parliament much more latitude. And so it's a good counterpoint to the other countries in the Gulf, Saudi Arabia, which does not have a parliament, and Qatar, which doesn't have a parliament, UAE, which does not have a parliament. And interestingly, Kuwait is the one that is far less concerned about its Islamist opposition as Islamists. It's just concerned about them as opposition because the Islamists there try to place constraints on the monarchy. They'll work across the aisle with the so-called liberal bloc. And so that's the worry. It's not an ideological concern. Contrast that with the UAE, which does not have a parliament and has almost no members of the Muslim Brotherhood. And yet, this is the group that the Emiratis obsess about.
Before we turn to the more cross-cutting stuff, just a word about Syria. When people think of Islamists now, invariably, people are thinking to some degree about Syria. So what does that landscape look like?
God, you've got every Islamist flavor you could possibly think of inside of Syria. And the Muslim Brotherhood is there as well. And they've been a political actor in Syria for decades. It was one of the earliest Muslim Brotherhood branches. But they had been chastened by their experience in the late 70s and early 80s of trying to overthrow current Assad's father and having failed and been put down brutally. And their organization outlawed, their membership sent into exile. And they have been much more tentative than this time around to really become part of the violent landscape. I mean, as the author documents in his chapter, they've tried, they put their toe in the water. It's just they weren't very good at it. They didn't have many connections on the ground because they had been in exile for so long. So they have put the balance of their energy into trying and shaping the external political landscape and to build ties with the international community. And so the kind of political language they speak is very much attuned to more Western liberal values. The documents that they've come out with over the past few years have been, you know, much more the language of human rights and democracy and elections. But as a consequence of not having a violent wing, I think, you know, their cause and their leverage as an external political actor, wouldn't you say, Shadi, has suffered in some measure, which is kind of one of the sad but obvious lessons from these conflicts, is that if you don't have guys with guns, your ability to shape not just the internal political landscape but the external landscape is much more limited as a consequence.
But as Will also said, I mean, they did try to tip their toes into the violent water, if you will, but this gets at, I think, at a really fascinating thing, is that the Brotherhood's skill set is not violence. Even when they try to be violent and have a kind of allied militia, as they did in this case, it was called the Shields, it just doesn't work out that well, because to have a good military wing and to be effective on the battlefield, you have to be a bit radical. War has a radicalizing effect, and that's why I think we see in the case of Syria that the most effective armed actors are the ones that are more comfortable with violence, because the Brotherhood is less comfortable with violence because of, in part, their history. It's just not something that they almost feel a little bit half-hearted in their violence, and I think that undermines their effectiveness.
So one of the really interesting things about this project is that you've actually pretty systematically involved Islamist voices in the volume. These are in the second half of the book after you've done this geographic survey. Tell us about, you know, how this came to be and what the nature of this engagement looked like.
I think the common academic way to do this is that you would take tracts written by Islamist actors and translate them and shove them in an appendix, and maybe your authors have reacted to those in some way. But it's a pretty static enterprise, and the conversation is one way. What Shadi and I wanted to do was involve these actors that were being studied much more in the process, and to illuminate this dynamic for what it is, which is an interchange between analysts who study this thing and that thing reacting to the analysis, and then the analysts themselves rethinking what they've written. And so this book then is an attempt to give voice to the Islamists, but make sure they are in conversation with the scholars, and the scholars really shaping the debate. So it's not the Islamists just given a platform and allowed to speak unchallenged to the world, but it's really in conversation with the scholars that are studying them, which is unusual for a publication on political Islam.
And yet, you have been criticized for giving Islamists a platform in this book. So talk a little bit about the criticism and the complaint.
Well, I always get attacked for that. For maybe for Will, it's a little bit more new. But as someone who spent a lot of time with members and leaders of these movements, I've sort of gotten used to, especially on Twitter, folks characterizing me in a certain way and what have you. But you know, I think from my standpoint, I don't think that you can write about Islamists or understand them without actually talking to them. And I take that very seriously as a researcher. And it seems obvious to me that you would need to have that kind of dynamic. But perhaps, you know, for others, that still can be a controversial thing in D.C. But I think, as Will said, what was really important was we asked them, and we made sure this was a part of their responses, that they couldn't just give us the standard sort of press release, Islamists are nice and fluffy and love democracy and all of that. We said, hey, this is a project about rethinking political Islam. So we are asking you specifically to write about what that rethinking entails. And we actually did get that out of these contributors, where you do see significant self-criticism about mistakes they had made, say, in the early months or years of the Arab Spring. And also, and part of what we did too was put Islamists in a room, not just with Will and myself, but also with some of the other kind of Western academic contributors. And we had several meetings over the years where we've tried to do this, and that can be very useful as well, to also not just have academics talking to Islamists, but as Will said earlier, what happens when you put one Islamist from, say, Yemen with an Islamist from Indonesia? They know nothing about each other's context, and that forces them to be like, hey, there are other ways of looking at things.
What was striking about the conversation with all of these groups, Ben, is that in the Arab world, what we discovered is there is a major obsession with elections and winning elections that you don't find, say, in other parts of Africa, that you don't find necessarily in South or Southeast Asia, where Islamists either don't participate in politics, find other ways to press, or they're happy being very minority groups that apply pressure. In the Arab world, there is an obsession with winning and through elections. And one of the ironies is that, as a number of the authors point out, this obsession in some measure comes from the pressure from Western governments on these groups over decades to participate in the political process, to participate in elections. And so a lot of these groups have learned, perhaps overlearned, those lessons. And so when you talk to, say, the Egyptians or the Moroccans or others, many of those Islamists can't imagine a politics that isn't moving to win as many votes as possible. That is the measure of success. And it's in striking contrast to Islamists in other parts of the world.
And one especially fascinating contrast is if you take Moroccan Islamists and Pakistani Islamists. So in Morocco, the PJD has actually been in government. The prime minister for the last few years has been an Islamist. And not a lot of people, you know, seem to be aware of that, I guess, because the monarchy gets more attention and the monarchy does have veto power over all major decisions. So you can be an Islamist party that keeps on winning. You have the prime minister's seat, but then it raises this broader question. What is the broader impact you're having on society if there are built-in limitations on what you can actually accomplish? Where if you take Pakistan, they only have a handful of seats in parliament, but you could argue, and I think we would argue, that Jamaat-e-Islami in Pakistan is more influential in terms of reshaping the educational curricula, influencing judicial appointments, getting their ideas out to a larger audience, even though they do pretty badly in elections.
The book is Rethinking Political Islam. Shadi, Will, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to tweet the Lawfare Podcast, share it on Facebook, and give it a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution system you may use. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.